As we've heard in previous programmes, the Beach Boys had had various disagreements with their record company over the years, and these were highlighted at the time of the release of Pet Sounds. Carl Wilson.
Capitol Records. There was a very nice man there named Carl Ingerman, who was really the guy that we knew, you know, the man that we talked to there. The others we didn't really trust because we thought they were weird or phony or something. But he was pretty much with what Brian wanted to do, although he was responsible, you know, for a certain area of activity within Capitol Records, and he had to answer to people higher up, you know, than himself. They were just very resistant to going forward musically.
As was shown by the fact that they released The Best of the Beach Boys, Volume 1, within a month of the release of Pet Sounds. The title of the album is self-explanatory, and although we've heard most of the songs already in this series of programmes, its release does give us the excuse to play a couple of numbers that we've missed so far. Do You Want to Dance and You're So Good to Me from the British version of The Best of the Beach Boys. And I make that distinction because the selections on the British and the American copies are different. And there are also two more tracks on the British version of both Volume 1 and Volume 2. Well, for once, British is best. Anyway, Bruce Johnston has pointed out that despite Capitol's hesitancy regarding Pet Sounds, a single was released featuring two of the songs from the album, Wouldn't It Be Nice and God Only Knows. That was released in August of 1966, and by October the next one was due. But how do you follow two such fine songs? Maybe Brian Wilson knew all along that he'd written a song that could follow just about anything. He got Carl to listen to the backing track in his customary manner.
Yeah, he played this weird thing on the phone, and it was Good Vibrations, and it was a really funky track. It was just more of a sort of let it rip drums, you know, smashing and stuff. And then it sort of refined itself, and then he got into the cello, quarter note triplets, and that, and the theremin. Of course, the first time he used theremin was on Just Wasn't Made for These Times. And he just saw it in the studio and said, "What is that?" And the guy who was playing trombone on the session said, "Oh, that's a theremin." He played it for him, and so they used it, and then he really liked it.
The theremin is the device that makes the whistling sounds on the two tunes that Carl mentioned, and it's a sort of sophisticated tone generator. Anyway, the music track was written, so what about the lyrics? Here's Mike Love.
I wrote the lyrics to Good Vibrations on the way down the Hollywood freeway about 10 minutes before the session. And it was a unique experience. I was dictating the words as we were driving down the freeway. It's kind of amazing. It's kind of one of those cliffhangers. We need some words. Okay, let's see.
I love the colorful clothes you wear.
Another number one for the Beach Boys, their first million-selling single in the USA, and certainly amongst the top five singles of the 1960s. Like the Pet Sounds album, Good Vibrations was particularly well-received in England.
I have to compliment the English for their total acceptance of Pet Sounds and Good Vibrations. That was the only saving grace. You know, I don't know why. I guess they're just more sophisticated in their musical taste. That's all I can think of. You know, it's a compliment.
And a gratifying one, too, from Al Jardine. The group decided to capitalize on their record successes in Britain and undertake their first playing tour in November of that year. The promoter was Arthur Howes.
It was one of those things which came to us through the good offices, really, of a person called Dick Duryea, and who was looking after them at that time. They topped the bill because they were very, very popular here. It was all in the Beatles era, and as far as American groups were concerned, I think they were the top American act. Complete sellout everywhere they went. And it was all the Scream era, and they got it all.
It was a sort of feeler tour of eight theatres, two shows a night, and the timing was perfect. For when they opened at the Finsbury Park Astoria on that first night, the Good Vibrations single was already number two in the charts. Their publicity man in England for that tour was Roger Easterby.
Basically, because at that time I was working for Arthur Howes, and it was natural that, you know, I would get totally involved with them as an act. And, of course, I spent most of the time with them during that period on their own private aircraft and things like that. But they were a very promotion-conscious group, which was amazing, because I don't think anybody realised until they actually came over here how big they were, and it was surprising to see this sort of fan worship they had. But of course they were a very professionally organized group as well. That I think was an insight to me, having worked with British groups and seeing how things were thrown together, to see even down to the last detail. It was very much like relating it over here to a football team, where they were in the dressing room and they would have a team talk. This would happen with the Beach Boys. A production manager would say to them, "Now tonight, fellas, you've got 45 seconds to come off stage." And he would really ruck them if they were longer than that. He said, "Look, fellas, it took you 49 seconds to get off stage tonight, and I told you you've got to get off in 45. And this was, you know, really amazing, the fact that when they changed into their, you know, what I relate as their Sheffield Wednesday shirts. You remember the blue and white shirts, which they wore to this time. It was a uniform. And, they, you know, it was like rubbing down with White Horse oils. They would all change at the, immediately the same time. The whole thing was such a professional operation. I'm sure it rubbed off on a lot of British acts later on. I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to how businesslike these guys were. I mean, off stage, like anybody else, they were lunas and they used to separate and have a great time. We did one of the theatres at Manchester. That was an incident where we had to get Mike Love through. The others had gone on ahead, but Mike was finishing a meal at the hotel, and we had to think of a way of getting him into the theatre. And in fact, what we did, there was a news seller down the road, and we borrowed his cloth cap. He wore these typical North of England cloth caps, and we put a muffler around Mike, and we put this cloth cap on him, and we walked in with the crowd, and we walked down the centre aisle, and we used the exit under the stage. That was the very first thing at Manchester. That's why that one sticks vividly in my mind. The fan following was just absolutely amazing. The girls, you know, just would do anything to get into the dressing room, and to get them out of theatres was just an amazing scene. You had to think of new ideas all the time. I think, you know, once we got into a car, and there were three girls on the floor of the car who actually got in, whether they'd bribed the driver or not, I don't know, but they were in the car waiting, you know. I think they enjoyed the ride. It starts with just a little glance
now, right away. So the concerts were very successful, but meanwhile, back in California, Brian had undertaken the task of writing and producing their next album.
As a producer, I really think the only place for an artist to go is further. And I think Brian finally reached a point there where I thought he was free. That he would do things that he wasn't strapped into, he hadn't done in the past, and I thought this is some sort of freedom that he's gotten within himself, which will be marvelous if he continues it. And somewhere along the line, Brian got boxed in again. I thought the catalyst of the reason was that he had made such a different and such a far-out album for that period and for that group. I think he scared of himself. And he went back into the box. And I think because he was by himself, he just freaked out. So I think he ran to Van Dyke Parks because there was some sort of security, like everybody's told me he's right and he's good. So I know my work can't be bad then, because I'll be working with him. What Brian, I think, failed to see was he was just brilliant and he was fine. He was afraid to be great by himself in case he wasn't great. He thought it'd be easier to fail with a partner, you know. And I think that was still good for him, you know, working with Van Dyke Parks. But I don't think that was Brian, because now we're only getting half of Brian. We still have another influence on his music. And the objective viewpoint is good, but he didn't need a partner, you see. It was like he kept putting up obstacles to himself.
Well, whilst not necessarily agreeing with all the sentiments expressed there by record producer Nick Vernay, it is true to say that Van Dyke Parks was probably the strongest personality outside the group that Brian had yet been involved with. Previously, Brian had co-written some of his songs with Mike Love or other songwriters such as Gary Usher and Jan Berry, disc jockey Roger Christian, and most recently on Pet Sounds with advertising man Tony Asher. Here's Marilyn Wilson.
Brian, you know, he enjoyed that. He really doesn't like to work alone as far as, like, writing. But Tony, he came up with some good lyrics and ideas with Brian. Mm. I think the ideas were all Brian's, but these people collaborated with lyrics. Mm. So he worked with him on Pet Sounds, a lot of the songs, and then we never saw him again. They come and they go. No, he was good. He was. If he wasn't good, Brian wouldn't have been with him.
Well, no, he wasn't. He was with Van Dyke Parks, and anyone who's met him will testify to the fact that he has a flow of ideas, an agility of mind, and a flexibility of speech that can leave you breathless just listening to him. Fortunately, some of his requests are easily granted.
Can I have some celery? Listen, they found Ewell Gibbons recently starving to death, surrounded by 45 acres of celery. This is what we call monoculture in the United States. I go to a supermarket to get that kind of news. Thank God this hotel has celery. So it's about the Beach Boys.
Well, we will do that. We will. One of the songs they recorded at the time was written by Van with Brian Wilson and was simply called Vegetables. Marilyn Wilson again.
That was a great song.
Yeah.
I remember on that song, when they were doing the vocals on it, Paul McCartney had come in town that day, and Brian had met him before, and I guess Paul, you know, wanted to meet with Brian and the guys again. And so he came over to the studio there, and I don't know who got all the vegetables, but Brian wanted carrots and celery. And they, when they were doing it, they were actually chomping on vegetables. And Paul came in the studio, and he didn't know what was happening. And Brian's sitting there, you know, at the board, mixing down certain vocals, and he's taking a celery stick, and he takes this big thing of salt and just, like, throws it on the table there, you know, here in the middle of the studio, and starts taking a celery stick like this, and Paul looks at him like, you know, ooh, what is happening? And all of a sudden, he picks up a celery stick and does the same thing. It was really funny. But Brian was really into vegetables then.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chop down.
Well, to hear his version of how the association with Brian began, developed and finished, as well as a few other tales along the way, I'll leave you for a few minutes with the thoughts of Van Dyke Parks.
I met him on the lawn of Terry Melcher's house, Doris Day's son, for whom I have the greatest respect, and who's coming out with an album of his own. Those were the days of considerable drug abuse, not among us, but surrounding us. The individuality of each man was tested during the group grope that occurred in 1966 when I met Brian Wilson on Terry Melcher's lawn. Brian said, come on up and listen to some sounds. I went up to his house. He had a four-track, he had an eight-track, whatever machinery he had. And an artist he was, deserving of this equipment that impressed me, along with the steaming swimming pool at Brian's house, which on that mountaintop in the Hollywood Hills was an example of the energy expanse, the avarice or apparent avarice of what Hollywood represents. Brian Wilson and I then went into a collaboration at his house between the swimming pool operations and my jumping through his sandbox to his Steinway piano. Brian did all the music, all of it. He was the central source of what we call ideas today when we talk about copyright. Brian was the only person I knew. And I worked for the Beach Boys in 1966. And by 1967, I was fired because it was already decided quickly by Mike Love as well. I mean, down to the least known members, that I had written some words which were indecipherable and unnecessary. In short, they had had a better lyricist on Pet Sounds than they had on what is now called Smiley Smile. Smile, the album that was to have come out, which was Proof of Pudding, which took place during the transference of a tremendous amount of litigation. Show business is the most litigious business in the world. It is only second to the legitimate sale of drugs in terms of cash flow worldwide. That's why a dollar a record makes sense to an American dollar consciousness. There are no interest rates. There's no paper deals like movies. Records are the name of the game, as Groucho Marx said to me the other day. They'll spend their last buck on entertainment. So where does that leave me?
Talk about Smile More and how much time you spent working on that.
We spent easily, after Pet Sounds, which is my favorite Beach Boy album, in Smile, the recording, the studio experience itself became more emphatically and demonstrably and persuasively dominant over the way a performance would take place in a proscenium. Great story. For example, Good Vibrations, the cello. The man played triplets. He played the fundamental to the chords. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he played, this is Jesse Ehrlich. He came in and played the cello, see, to make it right. Now, I couldn't play cello. I said, Arco Brian. He went into the talk back from the control booth. The first string player that he had ever assailed of such veteran ability. And he said, Barco. The man played Good Vibrations. Sound, the studio sensation was no longer the performance. Something tremendously individual happened that only improved the value of the group to enforce it in performance. I have a feeling that Good Vibrations is what guides me. I wrote Heroes and Villains with Brian. He said, da ta da da ta 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 ta. Immutable. I put a sentence on that because I worked for Brian, not with. He was it. I've been in this town so long that back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone, unknown for a long, long time. Fell in love with an innocent girl. Okay, you know, I forget the lyrics. It was a great tune. I've been in the town.
Heroes and Villains, released as a single and as a track on the album Smiley Smile. But if by this time you're a little confused as to where Smile ended and Smiley Smile began, don't worry, because so is Brian's wife, Marilyn.
You know, to this day, I do not know what Smile consists of. To me, Smile is just a lot of things that they've already put into other songs. You know, I mean, really. One thing about when Brian writes, if he writes something, he may take and put three different riffs or ideas from one song he's writing into another song. I mean, it's just so confusing. He knows what it's all about. I don't. The only thing I can think of is the Fire song, which was just, there were never any words put to it. But I don't know what else they intended to put in there.
The Fire song that Marilyn referred to was a piece of music often known as Mrs. O'Leary's Cow, but always referred to as Fire, and written as a part of a suite entitled The Elements. On the day of the session, Brian sent Marilyn scurrying about Los Angeles to collect as many firemen's helmets as she could for the session musicians to wear. Brian thought it would help the musicians get the right feel for the music. Anyway, back to Van Dyke Parks.
The way he treats string players is with don't get me hung up in your qualifications and your lingo and your lexicon and your terminal dynastic scholarly interests, string players. I don't care if you are the first violinist of the L.A. Philharmonic or just a Sharpie. Play the notes. And Brian, to prove himself, went out one day. What a bodacious spirit, what enterprise, what Yankee ingenuity came from Brian Wilson when he presented in 2 hours' time those string parts that mystified people on the issue of fire. Fire didn't come out because it was burning down too many buildings. String section was just sliding all over the place, and it was Brian's notation without a copyist that provided that ensemble response.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but it is true that there were coincidentally several major fires in the Los Angeles area just after the work was recorded. It isn't true, however, that the tapes of that or any of the other sessions were ever destroyed. The reason for their non-release, Hal Jardine attributes to Brian's disappointment with the acceptance of Pet Sounds in America.
The acceptance on the album was so late in coming that by that time he just decided the game was over. Just decided, what's the point, you know, putting anything into it. And he never really did, I don't think, recover from that, you know. He just decided that Maybe he'd wait for a while until the industry caught up or something. I don't know. We spent as much time on that album as we did on Pet Sounds. It's not far from completion. That could be completed if he wanted to put the energy into it. I don't think I'd attempt to do it because it's not my work, you know. I mean, I could finish it. I think Carl and I and Dennis probably and Mike could probably put it together, but I'd rather he did it. You know. It's in fragments. It's just a bunch of fragments. And they're really good. They're really superb fragments.
In fact, three of the songs originally intended for the Smile album have already appeared on subsequent albums, but in different forms from the way they were originally recorded. The songs are Cabin Essence on 2020, Cool Cool Water on Sunflower, and of course Surf's Up on the album of the same title. And we'll be hearing those as we get to the respective albums. Anyway, the next record release after Smiley Smile was the single that was to become the title track of the following album, Wild Honey. The whole of the Wild Honey album was recorded in Brian's home because as well as having a grand piano in a sandbox, as Van Dyke Parks mentioned earlier, it now had one room converted into a recording studio. He was now becoming both physically and spiritually more insulated from the outside world. In May of that year, though, promoter Arthur Howes had brought the rest of the group back to Britain for their second playing tour.
Just to prove what a professional type group they are and how much they think of their fans, there was a time when Carl was having a little problem with his passport, and we were opening up on the Friday night, I think it was, in Belfast, the Adelphi Belfast. And that same day, he still hadn't got a passport. And he got his passport about 12 hours before the curtain was due up in Belfast. He dashed out and hired a Learjet to bring him personally to the opening night. And he got there just in time for the curtain up and the concert.
The reason Carl had no passport was because it had been withdrawn when the FBI arrested him. He'd previously received his draft papers for the United States Services.
I got a notice to report for physical. And it was just one of those things that I never got around to thinking about or making a move on, because I just never came up, you know. And it came up. And so I thought, okay, now what is my position on this? And I just applied for conscientious objector on religious grounds. We were in court many times over about a six-year period. And it really showed me a really weird thing, because I spent quite a lot of money on the thing, and somebody in a less fortunate position would have really been in trouble, you know. And that was a very strange experience to go through. But in the end, the judge was very fair. And he gave me a chance to do the alternate service that I said I would do, you know, something in line with what, you know, I knew how to do. Most of the thing ended up in the voter registration effort that we did. You know, we registered quite a lot of people. So everything, you know, ended well. But the technical and legal thing was amazing, you know. And it got to right down to the very last appeal, the very last day the judge cooled out and it worked, you know. But I was convicted by a jury for failing to report for alternate service at the L.A. County General Hospital, right? And it's true, I failed to report, you know.
What actually happens then, Carl? If you say no, they propose that you...
Well, it depends. If you've got the muscle, you know, legally, you know, and you could go into court and fight it, then you can stay in. But if you don't, then you just off to the pokey, you know.
But fortunately, Carl's sojourn at the Pokey was a brief one, and he was soon on his way to Britain for the tour. Just as well, too, for as Roger Easterby says, Arthur Howes was more than keen to have them back again.
Well, yes, I mean, anybody who makes money, you want back. I mean, you know, he would have kept them over here permanent residence, I'm sure. And every theatre was a sellout, and, you know, there were the fans screaming backstage. In fact, very much like today you get with the Osmonds. I mean, that thing was very much to do with the Beach Boys all those years ago. I mean, they really only had to go on stage and do their hits, and that was all the public wanted, and it was so programmed, and the timing was superb. When he left me alone,
so, another successful tour for the group in Britain. Meanwhile, in America, a committee which included, amongst others, Paul McCartney, Andrew Oldham, Paul Simon, Derek Taylor, Terry Melcher, Lou Adler and Brian Wilson, were making plans to launch a three-day international festival of pop to be held in late June in Monterey, California. The performers not only had to agree to appear for free, but collectively had to provide $100,000 to finance the festival. Any gate receipts over that were to be used for financing music scholarships and non-establishment youth projects. Derek Taylor had been handling publicity for the Beach Boys in America since the time of Pet Sounds, so with him and Brian on the organising committee for the festival, it was no surprise that amongst the impressive list of artists booked to appear were the Beach Boys themselves. So what happened?
They dropped out. I forgive them, because I'm not God, and I'm not for me really to forgive them. But they shouldn't have dropped out. They were supposed to headline Saturday night. Tough 2 days, that was. I mean, it was really tough. I couldn't believe it. Nobody could believe it. Lou Adler said, "What? What?" I said, "They won't do it." He said, "What do you mean they won't do it? Everyone's doing it. Otis is doing it. Simon's doing it. John's doing it. They're all doing it." I said, "They won't do it." And they didn't do it.
Why not?
I don't know. Cold feet. Brian or something, I don't know with it. It was Brian's yes to me. But it got so hellish at the end that I can't remember where the no came from. I think probably Brian again. Came by proxy. I think maybe he shouldn't have said yes. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it was ever on. And then they took too long saying no. And the festival was the poorer without them, but it was so marvellous anyway that it, in the end it didn't matter. But it would have been better with them, because they were representative of very good music. I think everyone profited from that festival so much. It was such a turning point, but it would have helped them, yeah. Who knows what would have happened. In the event, they're doing okay. At the time, the feeling on Sunday night when the whole thing was over was, well, it was okay without them. But still a shame.
It was a great shame, but what effect did it have on the group's future career in America? Here's Mike Love.
Well, I always think that a main reason why we, other than the problems with the record company and them not promoting us in the way that we should have been promoted as an evolutionary, changing group, you know, other than that, I always point to the fact that we didn't get on that Monterey Pop Festival, from which festival a lot of superstars were made. You know, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Otis Redding, Grateful Dead, or Jefferson Airplane.
What was the reason for you not doing that?
Well, there were a lot of reasons. Carl Wilson had just been arrested by the FBI and was going through that. Dennis Wilson was going through some personal hassles himself, and I guess I was ready to go. Bruce is back. Brian was on the board of directors of the organization that was going to sponsor it. And then Brian got sort of cold feet on the situation, because he didn't really trust that the people there on that organization were going to do right with the money and everything. And sure enough, there was a scandal about that about a year or two after they'd done the show. And sure enough, not too many people were handed out scholarships and things, you know. But a couple of people had some nice houses and things. So there was that. And I guess Brian, being very intuitive, just didn't feel it was too right. So there wasn't a total agreement in the group to do that show. So we didn't. But out of that show, that was when really all that, I term acid and grass and all that, the dope went media. Went in mid-America. Before that, it was avant-garde a little bit, you know, the hippies, the artists, the everybody in the know, the little cliques and groups and musical groups and sort of heady groups were into it. But then it just went off, you know, mid-America, you know. Mm. So it was uncool to be too cherubic and surfy and all that, you know. It was into a whole other bag, and you had to be laid back and cool and smoke it and everything else. So, well, I think that had a lot to do with, our not being in that wave that swept over America that time.
It's true to say that the Beach Boys' non-appearance at the Monterey Festival heralded a period where the group as a whole now suffered a loss of momentum. Mike Love again.
I think we had tasted enough glories, if you know what I mean, like in terms of personal appearances and records. I mean, all had our material desires pretty well satisfied. We all bought our fancy homes and the swimming pools and had our Jaguars and Mercedes and Rolls Royces and things. So from that level, it was all satisfied. About December of 67, I remember meeting Maharishi in Paris. And, of course, he taught us how to do transcendental meditation. And so that appealed to me at the time. Ever since that time, I wanted to become a teacher. So I think the momentum of the group, if there was a momentum at that time, it wasn't the momentum of being a success and personal appearances and top 10 records as much as it was evolving in our music and as human beings, you know, as individuals, and the music as well. And I think it was like, when Excalibur the sword was forged, it must have been heated and then plunged into cold water. That just tempers the blade. And I think what those years of 67, 68, and 69 did is it cleared the decks for us. It tempered us as musicians. It made us become more serious musicians and not just get by and rely upon the overwhelming popularity that we had in the U.S. And of course, abroad in several places. But it really got us to think about developing ourselves and our music more.
How did you get involved in transcendental meditation, Mike?
Oh, well, we were invited to a United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, you know, UNICEF, and we were invited to go to Paris in December of 67. And I had heard about TM, transcendental meditation, before that, and had gone to a lecture, and I was kind of tired, and I kind of dozed throughout. So we went home, and we didn't actually start in L.A. We flew to Paris. We did this UN show with Victor Borga and Lena Horne and Marlon Brando and his Tahitian dancers and Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Ravi Shankar and the Red Army Choir and the Turkish Ballet. It was a monumental show. It had, you know, about four or six French singers that were real famous in France but I barely heard of, you know, that kind of thing. And just a beautiful show. And we were the only rock group on the show. And it so happened that George and John, you know, I bet you know who I mean. The boys, you know, the Liverpool lads, you know. The lads were there because they were at that time intrigued by Maharishi's practice of transcendental meditation and they were learning from him at the time. So we met Maharishi right there in the hall during rehearsals and it was kind of a funny story. We met him and talked to him. What do you think about astrology? We asked him all kinds of irrelevant questions. He says, oh, astrology's, we recognize that, but that's not what we're teaching. We're teaching this mental technique to give a deep relaxation and increase the use of your conscious mind and all that. And so it was interesting meeting him, but we were busy and we were running here and there, and we left. After the show, we left and went back from Paris to England. When I say we, my wife and I and one of the fellows that worked for us, a roadie. And the other guys remained in Paris, but I loved England a lot. I really liked England. I've always have. And I preferred the English atmosphere, shall we say, to French, you know. Anyway, we came back and I received a call. No sooner than I got into the hotel, I received a call from Dennis Wilson saying, hey, Mike, you got to come back to Paris. I said, what for? We just were there for a week. He said, well, Maharishi's going to teach us to meditate. And I said, you sure? He says, I think so. I said, well, before I go flying back across the channel, make sure, you know. So, sure enough, he calls back in about a half an hour and says, yep, Maharishi's going to teach us at 10 o'clock in the morning. Be here. And he says, but you have to get to sleep early because you're supposed to get a lot of rest, you know. You're supposed to bring a few things. And so we Went to bed at 8 o'clock at night and got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Flew back across the channel, landed, got in the cab. The cab driver turns around and says, you ever been to Paris before? And he said, yes. He said, when? Yesterday. Look at us crazy touristas, you know. So it was real fun. We went to the hotel and Maharishi gave us this, what is equivalent to an introductory lecture. And then in the afternoon we came back and he gave us another little talk. And then he taught us the technique of transcendental meditation. It was the most relaxed I've ever been in my life. You know, it was very relaxed and it was very simple to do. And I just remember thinking very clearly that this thing is so simple that if everybody could do it, because it is so simple, everybody could do it. And if everybody did it, it would be just a totally different world just based on the relaxation alone. Forget the mental development. Just if everybody were more relaxed, it would be a totally different situation in the world. So from the very first time I meditated, I was very intrigued about TM, and just a couple months later I found myself in India.
Whilst the influence of transcendental meditation was certainly to provide the group with a good deal of spiritual calm in the years to come, the more immediate future was to prove that their involvement with TM and with the Maharishi would have some quite disastrous results.